This podcast is presented by Brave Voice Films.
Frames of Reference.
Three films, two cinephiles, one podcast.
Cinema is my secret passion.
It's a foreign movie. A film is what it is.
But art films make people feel funny.
Yeah, we only show first-run art films here.
We're getting too many mainstream movies.
Episode one.
One where we really like Lynn Ramsey.
So, I'm Kyle Mahaney. I'm a film editor and filmmaker.
I'm Matthew Bonanno. I'm an engineer, and I watch a lot of movies, and I guess I'm also a filmmaker as well.
You guess?
I am. Legally speaking, I am indeed a filmmaker.
This is our first episode. Disregard the previous one. This one's definitely the first one. This is our podcast, Frames of Reference, where we are going to talk about three movies, and we're going to try to, in a totally not pretentious way, link them together by movement and theme.
Yep. Which is it's a fool's errand, because I guarantee you we're going to get there via pretentious means, but we're going to do our best.
Just trying to distill what makes film what it is today, how things build off of each other, and how people, you know, go see something interesting and a little offbeat.
Sure. So our format for this show is taking three movies, two of which are a little older, one of which is a little newer, and trying to link the three of them and kind of talking about the thematic or artistic connections between them in the way that film is so frequently built upon itself.
Yep.
To that point, the modern film that we're going to be looking at is You Were Never Really Here, which is Lynn Ramsey's new feature, starring Joaquin Phoenix. And we're also going to be looking at Ratcatcher, which was Lynn Ramsey's first film, as well as 400 Blows, which was Francois Truffaut's debut film, and basically, yeah, defined French New Wave.
Yeah, and starting off with You Were Never Really Here. So I saw this at Cannes last year. It's incredible.
I liked it a lot. To me, it was the film that would have been Drive if Drive were good.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. It's Lynn Ramsey, who's one of my favorite filmmakers, so just going to be totally upfront with that, adapting a Jonathan Ames novel. At Cannes, it took Best Screenplay and Best Actor. And it's really interesting that it didn't come out, because it sold at Cannes last year. And then it didn't come out until this year, which is interesting, because it could have absolutely been an awards consideration last year.
Do you think they'll go for awards this year then?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So Amazon is its U.S. distributor. They put it out for a limited theatrical in April. And it's now on Amazon Video as a rental. It should be on Prime soon, with a Blu-ray coming out on the 17th.
Critics like it a lot.
Also, it's available in the UK from Studio Canal, and it's already out. Critics love it. It's got 87% on the tomato meter, 84% Metacritic. If you are a home theater guy, the Amazon version is in 4K.
I really liked it.
Yeah, no, Joaquin Phoenix, Ekaterina Samsonov, this is a really good cast. It's a really driven film.
And I mean, and it's a really tight cast as well. It's like, basically, those are your two characters.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just this interpersonal drama that just moves really well. And it feels a lot like a 70s action movie at times, but then it goes dark.
Well, really dark. And that's why I think it reminds me a lot of Drive, which itself reminds me a lot of Michael Mann films. These are movies which frequently feature like a solitary male protagonist who's finding himself in increasingly horrifying circumstances, looking at a system that he thought not only that he knew, but that he mastered, and realizing that he has so much less control than he actually thought he did.
Yeah. Also, Johnny Greenwood did the score for this. And
the score was so good.
Absolutely perfect.
Yeah. Johnny Greenwood on the score, to bring back the Drive comparison again, it's that 80s revamped kind of feeling where it's got the kind of pulse and dark vibe of 80s music, but a little bit more minimalist, which I think worked in its favor. It was this mix of highly naturalistic and diegetic
sound.
The man
is energetic, though. Like, oh, well, the sound design in general, gosh. If you have access to see this on a good surround sound system, watch it.
So Joaquin Phoenix plays a hitman. He rescues young girls who are being trafficked kills their captors. He gets, again, with the Michael Mann and Drive thing, he gets, quote-unquote, one more job, and this one is just more than he bargained for. He realizes as he's going into it and rescuing the girl and taking out the people that are responsible for this, that it goes way higher than he thought and way higher than he is capable of taking out.
Yep.
And kind of parallel to this, he's got a relationship. He lives with his elderly mother.
Human.
Right. He's human and yeah, you're right. He's human. He's got this. He's not the
highly not the detached. Hardened, yeah.
Right.
It's not this Hollywood archetype we see of the, highly detached, masculine. Mm-hmm. And so this is Lynn Ramsey, who made Ratcatcher, which we'll be talking about next. But she's known for these human stories.
Well, yeah, I think what was we'll get into Ratcatcher. But what was interesting about You Were Never Really Here is that the hitman is actually one of the central points of humanity in the film.
Yep.
Which is an interesting inversion of what you usually see, wherein it's a hitman who has to navigate a human world, and the language that he has for it is really only one of violence. And that was a really interesting subversion of that archetype.
Yeah, and like Lynn Ramsey's known primarily for British realism work. Her last two films have not exactly been that, but that theme is still there. And British realism is a movement where it tends to deal with themes of the working class and class in general, and also just kind of these natural looks at human interaction. It's not very posed. It's not very...
I'm going to bring in literary references now, and it reminds me a lot of kitchen sink narratives, which are, based on literally like the idea that the sink and the kitchen are these central points of human interactions in lower class settings.
Yeah.
So that kind of brings back again that idea of highly naturalistic, very personally relatable stories, rather than a lot of what we see in films today is more of these grandiose stories. Particularly with films like Marvel, where you're increasing the scope of
this of your brings world. It in very small to the home,
right?
And like this, you can still see that this film is incredibly stylized.
Yes.
It's not something we would commonly associate with British realism. Her other most recent film, We Need to Talk About Kevin, is also like that. But you still see these roots of small scenes of interaction where this could have just been a Hollywood blockbuster action movie very easily.
Which I think is what makes her such a fascinating director. And Tilda Swinton said the same thing from We Need to Talk About Kevin. She was saying basically like if Lynn Ramsey weren't the person making these films, nobody would be making them. I don't know if it's like literally Lynn Ramsey's the only one, but she's such a singular voice for merging stylized trends and her roots of British realist drama to tell these really interesting stories that mix a lot of genre elements. Speaking of genre, I would add this has, and speaking of British realism, this has a lot of elements of a coming of age story.
Yes.
It's like a midlife crisis coming of age story, which again, I think could be used to describe.
And that's also look at Nina's character. Nina's character is very, very well portrayed. Lynn Ramsey's really good with kids.
Yes. Yeah.
She is fantastic at not being condescending with her child characters and just they're their own people trying to figure out their own world.
Yeah, she manages to simultaneously make them innocent and learning, and yet at the same time they know more than we or adults are inclined to give them credit for.
Yep.
I would argue that there is sort of a parallel of Joe's coming of age in realizing the world is so much bigger and more dangerous and horrifying than even I thought it was as a hitman who rescues trafficked girls.
Yeah.
And Nina's coming of age where she's abducted, she's forced into prostitution,
but she's still going, and I think that's a really interesting message.
Yeah. And I think part of the parallel for her and Joe is the fact that she's the one that brings Joe to come on and to continue.
When he's given up. Yeah.
Right, to find life and meaning, even though he's been so horrified and left basically devastated by the loss of everyone as he gets increasingly into these toxic pits of inhumanity and violence. She is the person that actually pulls him out. I think it's a really interesting way to look at trauma as this
almost we're in it this together.
Form of, Right, this solidarity movement.
Yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense. You know, we'll talk about Ratcatcher, but that makes a lot of sense when you look at Ratcatcher. And you see that these are two films by the same director that are on their face so different. But a lot of those same human roots and ideals are still there.
Also, like, this film is tight. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's short. It's 80-some minutes. And you never... It feels so tight. It has no fat on it. It just moves really well. And I think part of that's the score.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's what I was saying. The score being so minimalist and just every once in a while spiking on you, in addition to...
It moves the action forward so well. And everything is so tight. It just drives you to keep watching.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I'll say that doesn't necessarily mean it's a super accessible film on its face. You have to accept that... This is not like
it's an action movie. It's still challenging a little bit.
Yeah.
Like,
but
it's a pretty challenging film, actually. It doesn't spell things out in a super obvious way. You're going to have to think a little bit about who these people are. And that's good because it pushes you.
Yeah.
This is where we sound like film snobs.
Right. But it is what I really am hopeful about thriller films and in sort of the modern indie renaissance of the name is we're getting a little bit away from... You know, the more dime a dozen, you know, man on the run, whatever films.
Yeah.
And you're getting more into these more probing psychological, interpersonal, social films of humanizing the thriller so that even though it is extraordinary circumstances that very few audience members have actually literally found themselves in, there is a human element that we can be drawn to in it.
Yeah. And that's – it ends – in a way that I kind of want to see a sequel, but I never want to see a sequel.
Yeah, I don't think a sequel would be appropriate.
Oh, no, no, of course not. But, like, you can envision the future. And there's a,
right.
The envision is not dreamy, per se.
Yeah. God, I keep on name-dropping Michael Mann, but I really do think it's important.
Oh, no, this has huge overtones of Michael
Mann. This is such a Michael Mann / neo-noir film where you have the man on the run and the horrifying pits of inhumanity that he's finding himself in. But it's one of those, I mean, it's a Lynn Ramsey, very bittersweet, hopeful ending.
Yeah.
Where yes, everything is horrible and you've been duped into thinking that you understood it, but also you can keep going.
Yep. Also one thing that I find interesting that this is kind of mirrored in a bunch of other of her films is someone entirely unsuited and unprepared taking on kind of a parental role.
Mm.
Of taking someone under their wing. We'll talk about that in Ratcatcher a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. I would agree with that. That's a very perceptive way to look at it.
It's kind of that theme of, you know, your parents are not around to look out for you, but people do.
Well, yeah, and I think that's what makes his relationship with his mother so important and humanizing is
he understands fact that the value of that.
Right. You see a lot of this laid down even early on in the film, before everything starts to go to hell.
You know something was off with his childhood.
Right. And because you just see the way that he mothers his mother, or he parents his mother, to not gender it. He's a very affectionate son who has to take care of the people that maybe traditionally you would want to take care of him.
Yep. And moving on to Ratcatcher, which is Lynn Ramsey's premiere film. Decades earlier. So Ratcatcher premiered at the 1999 Cannes Film Festival, where it screened in the Un Certain Regard category. It received the Carl Foreman Award for Newcomer in British Film from the BAFTA. It never had a wide release in America. And, you know, this was the late 90s where the term wide release was basically any release. I think it only screened New York and LA.
Yeah.
It is kind of difficult to find. It's not on any streaming service currently. There's never been a Blu-ray. And in the US, you can get it on DVD from Criterion. And in the UK, it's on DVD from BFI. But if you're in the UK, import the Criterion DVD, because I've seen the BFI DVD. It's not very good. But it was critically acclaimed, and it's a film that... So on release, it got 84% on the Rotten Tomatoes Tomato Meter, and it has 76% from Metacritic, which seems a little low, honestly, given in the last few years how much this film has entered into conversation. Like, Barry Jenkins, director of Moonlight, has repeatedly referenced this as an influence.
Hmm.
Sean Baker, the director of The Florida Project, is said it's one of his favorite films. Like, this is a film that's influencing the current generation of indie filmmakers. And it's kind of interesting that it gets lost a lot and that it hasn't kind of had that regard.
I mean, again, I may be part of why we wanted to make this podcast in the first case was that there is so much good cinema out there that a lot of people, including ourselves, haven't gotten a chance to see just because a lot of it has to do with how accessible it is in terms of even finding it to watch.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things is almost every actor except for Tommy Flanagan, who plays the father, was an amateur actor with no prior experience.
And that makes so much sense when you watch the film.
Yeah. Like, it's very natural. It feels super real. Lynn Ramsey's daughter, Lynn Ramsey Jr., played Anne Marie, the little sister in it. So that's interesting. She uses her quite a lot in her films.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I think if you looking at how her films look at family.
Yeah, well, that's every single one of her films looks at family and in a very unusual way. Ratcatcher is set in inner city Glasgow in the early 1970s during the garbagemen strike, where the city is covered in filth because the garbage has not been hauled away. It's really interesting because you have this big Victorian city and yet the houses are all projects.
Right.
And like these people are living in filth, real filth. It's kind of remarkable that conditions were like this.
Oh, yeah.
In a major European city in the 1970s.
I think that does a lot of work for establishing this community as this incredibly
working class.
Insulated, but yeah, forgotten working class. Yeah,
forgotten. Group That's of people. A huge thing. A huge theme is the working class people being forgotten. So the film follows, at the start, we think the film follows a kid named Ryan Quinn.
Is that the boy on the cover art?
Yeah.
It looked like him, and I was incredibly surprised by the beginning.
Yeah, it follows Ryan Quinn, who's this, middle school-aged boy who is being forced to go visit his father in prison, and he runs away from his mom because he doesn't want to go see his father in prison, and goes to play with his mate James, and they start roughhousing as boys of that age do, and Ryan falls into the creek, or canal, I guess it is.
Yeah, they call it a canal, which, honestly,
it's a creek.
I was trying to...
It is the most disgusting body of water I've ever seen.
Yeah, well, and that's... Yeah, it's... I think the centralization of the canal is a pretty important, like, visual metaphor. As this natural thing that's been almost poisoned by the conditions around it and become this incredible danger despite not being, it shouldn't have to be that way.
And so he falls in and he doesn't come up. And James, who had been roughhousing with him, kind of freaks out and runs away instead of asking for help, alerting people.
Yeah.
But James thinks no one saw it. And that's kind of this internal struggle of James throughout the entire film. This film has a lot of threads going on in it as well, though. Like, you have the family is going to be rehoused through a social services program and moved up to the suburbs, supposedly. But it keeps getting delayed, and their house is being inspected.
Yeah, you get, again, the kind of endless...
The working class people being presented with endless problems that keep them from happiness.
Right. As a result of not only being forgotten, but even just being, like, continually pushed a little bit further down the line in this actually really very Kafka-esque sort of situation where you're, like, you're sitting there and you're like, people are, like, we people lived like this.
James is searching for something else. He doesn't really quite know. And it's really interesting how he does not fit in his family.
Yeah.
Which is funny because it also kind of suggests that Margaret Ann, his little sister, is also going through with that at a different stage. But this film is very clearly from James's point of view.
Yeah.
So, like, there's hints. You know, there's this famous sequence where he just rides the buses out to the suburbs and walks around these empty prefab houses. Mm. And, like...
It's a beautiful moment of...
Realizing what he doesn't have.
Right. And this is why I think the connections between Ratcatcher and You Were Never Really Here are so interesting is it's sort of the inverse of You Were Never Really Here, where it's this beautiful moment of recognition, or not even beautiful, it's bittersweet, but it's beautiful in realizing there's this whole world out here that I have no...
A wide open field, literally.
Yeah, that I have no way of even accessing because of the conditions I was born into.
Yeah.
So being a coming-of-age film, a lot of this film's focus is on James's masculinity and, like...
He's a very sensitive kid. It's kind of implied that he's gay.
Would you say so? Yeah, you know, I guess that's right. I would agree with that.
It's implied. There's no evidence to substantiate it, but it's implied that he's at least not as masculine as his peers are. And
right.
He's not... I mean, there's a scene in which he's naked with another girl, and he's infatuated with her as a person, but there's nothing sexual.
Right. That was... Yeah, that scene is wonderful.
And I think that's really interesting because he's kind of processing his opinions about sex. Who knows? Right. Who knows what's going on in his head there, but he's not fitting into the traditional approach for how things are perceived that a boy his age should be.
Well, yeah, and I think that's what a big part of the film's conflict comes from, like a roving band of young 13 to 16-year-old hooligans who are basically, well, I mean,
the list
is endless. Yeah, they bully and hurt a lot of the kids that are younger than them. There's a lot of sexual harassment and violence towards the girls in the community. It's another one of those things that is incredibly visible and incredibly unacceptable, but the community almost doesn't know how to even rein it in.
And even Margaret Ann, the girl that he befriends, you know, she is straight up being abused and harassed by these bullies, but she still allows them to sleep with her.
She doesn't understand, I think, that it doesn't have to be like that and that she doesn't have to experience that.
Yeah.
And so that's where a lot of the film's bittersweet ideas of gender and maturity come in.
And I think maturity is really interesting because James is kind of on the cusp of an adult understanding of things.
Right.
That's, I think, one of the really interesting things about the lack of sexuality in his friendship with Margaret Ann. But he's on the cusp where he's starting to learn how the adult world works.
Right. And
but he also has one of these friends, Kenny, who is very much not there yet.
Yeah.
And it just kind of covers that interesting time where everyone's just kind of figuring out how things actually work and not everyone reaches that at the same time.
Yeah. I you know, certainly what kicks off the conflict in the story with Ryan's death is the fact that James almost refuses to address it in a way that is mature. Not even necessarily to fault him, he's a kid, but he, instead of actually looking and being like, oh, he's drowning, he runs away because he doesn't have a language for it yet.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the film from there is him taking these halting steps out into the real world of people and understanding what role he plays there.
And like, in many ways, he still is a child. He still like horribly bullies his little sister.
Yeah.
Like, he still is, you know, fighting his mom as she's trying to comb the bugs out of his hair.
Yeah, he's very much the middle sibling with a younger and an older sister.
And the older sister's very detached.
Yes.
But it really captures a lot there of that cusp.
I think a lot of his relationship with his father are informed by that masculinity that we were talking about, where I think he sees in his dad, who is not quite deadbeat, but pretty deadbeat.
Yeah.
He's frequently drunk. He can be abusive towards, particularly towards James and towards his wife.
He's very sweet to Anne Marie, though.
Yeah.
He enables her a little too much, actually.
Oh, yeah. I think that he reflects a lot of someone who himself has struggled to come out of where he's from.
And in a way, he kind of does. He's rescues another child who later in the film falls in, which kind of shows to James how things could have gone differently for Ryan Quinn.
How things could have gone differently. And it's one of the pockets of humanity that sort of shines brightly in all of these other horrible circumstances.
Yeah.
Is the fact that there is still this community here that does at their root care about each other and want to improve their conditions and just don't have the means to do that.
Yeah.
Partially as a result of their own sort of, I don't want to say as a result of their own immaturity, because there are certainly enormous economic and systemic
as a result of the systemic here. Barriers that prevent them from playing the way that things should play.
Right. But at the same time, at one point in the film, some council members come kind of surprise James and his father to talk about the new house and to make sure that their living conditions indicate that they would, you know, be a good fit for the suburbs or whatever. And it's not great because it's right after his father had rescued the boy from the canal. And so he is lying in a drunken stupor, covered in mud in his underwear with peanuts just sort of littered across his body. The house is a mess.
As his daughter lets the council members in.
I think James actually lets them in, which is important because we had seen at an earlier point that Anne-Marie had prevented the council members from coming in by lying and covering for her mother, who's hiding in the kitchen, and saying, oh, no, she's not in. But James fails to do this because he is even a little bit more naive than Anne-Marie was.
Yeah.
And his hope was that, oh, I've now seen this suburban house. I would love
to I want to be there.
Yeah, and these people are going to help me get there, and not the reality, which is these people represent the system of economic inequality that are going to prevent people like me from getting there. Unfortunately, you know, his father blames him for that, even though part of it is, well, you know, the father was lying there in his underwear drunk.
Yeah.
It's this offloading of those responsibilities onto the child because the father has failed to develop the tools to handle those situations.
It's really interesting because up until a certain point, everything in this film feels very natural. And you're always convinced that you're seeing a very straightforward portrayal of life. And then as we get into the final act of the film, you start to question things. That's one of the things that makes this film very unique.
Yeah, and a little divisive, I think, as well.
Is you start to realize James is a little bit of an unreliable narrator.
We see, I mean, we maybe first see that with that sequence where Quinn sends his rat to the moon by tying a balloon to its leg.
Kenny, not Quinn. Quinn's dead.
Oh, you're right.
Quinn's bird.
Kenny. Right. Yeah, you're right. Quinn is, that's right. Quinn is Ryan. Kenny attaches a balloon to the leg of his, of a mouse that he had gotten for his birthday. And he, you know, that mouse flies away, and then we're treated to like lunar landing looking videos of just mice colonizing the moon. But the unreliable narration gets a little bit less whimsical and a little bit more stark and depressing
as things go on.
Yeah, towards the final act of the film.
Just the end of this film is it leaves you with more questions than answers, and I think that's great.
Sure.
You hope for the best, but in the deep inside, you know, it's not the best.
Yeah. Because what happens, do you want to get more into
the ending? Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think it makes a little bit more sense for this. So what happens is eventually the military is called in to basically scab against the union men who are striking against the, you know, against picking up garbage. And that kind of triggers, I think, the final moment in...
Oh, because it's James realizing that things are never going to get better.
Well, not only are things never going to get better, but even... I'm not going to say that I take the side of sending the military in to scab against unions. But even as he watches people from the union and people in the community jeering and attacking the military men because they represent a continuation of economic inequality rather than an answer to the needs that the union was putting forward. He realizes that part of it is that they are stuck here by their own lack of ability to look out and to move out.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Again, not in that they could do it if it were all, you know, it's not about picking themselves up by their bootstraps, but also seeing to a degree that, some of the people that, I mean, a lot of the people that he's growing up with.
Poverty is systemic and it's really hard to get out of the situation.
Partially because
they're just ill prepared.
Yeah. to get out there. And so
with that, you know, James loses faith.
Yeah.
And it, you kind of question, the film paints a picture after that of things getting better, but you have reason to doubt they actually did. And I think that's very interesting because it's very, very visually poetic how the film ends.
Oh, yeah.
But you also have every reason to understand that that is a fantasy.
Right. It's so arresting because it's built on the past hour of intense naturalism and intense realism. And
then it you're changes treated, dramatically in tone.
Well, and you're treated to this, I would say, not fantastical scene, but it's fantastical in that you can't imagine
the circumstances that really happened. That way.
Yeah. It's very bittersweet. I mean, I don't even know if I would call it sweet. Depends on how much of it you buy into.
Yeah. It's really interesting because I first saw this film in middle school. And it was one of the first, I watched this film and My Life is a Dog, which is a very similar movie, within a couple weeks of each other because they were on Netflix back then, like right when Netflix was starting to do streaming video. And I find it interesting, I kind of interpret it as the happy ending.
Yeah, it...
And I, as an adult, I don't see that anymore.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how I... What exactly... I still am not certain what I even necessarily think of the ending tonally.
Yeah.
It's...
But I think it fits in with childhood of, you know, you escape. You claw away and escape. And James goes back into... In those last few minutes, he goes back to one of those childish moments of balling right. up and escaping because he has not matured. He has, right. he is enlightened. You know, this is the same as the next one we're going to talk about, the battle between childhood and enlightenment. But he is enlightened, but he does not have the emotional maturity to handle that. So he balls up and goes to this escapist world.
And I think it's intriguing, again, to compare this to You Were Never Really Here, where I think certainly the same thing... Everything's topsy-turvy. Well, so I would say that Joe was going to basically do the same, react the same way that James did by refusing to confront it, and instead basically just removing himself from it. Instead, Nina
pushes him on.
Right. Is that he has somebody else to draw him out of that. And for a while, I think it seems like Margaret Ann could be the person to do that, but I think she's similarly uncertain of how to do it. And I think she's also
very equally
trapped.
Yeah.
Yeah, trapped and traumatized similarly.
Yeah, and like, I think Anne Marie, the younger sister, is a really fascinating character in this because she's someone who is just handling things better than he is. But she also does that. She also clicks back into that childish mode.
She's a little better at, but she has, yeah, she's a little bit more able to confront reality and even a little bit like her oldest sister, whose name I can't remember.
I think it's Ellen.
Yeah, Ellen. Even like her oldest sister, Ellen, I think part of it is that she's able to detach and even almost exploit the situation and Absolutely. Understanding that she is, like, as a young girl, she can get away with
certain some things. Stuff. Yeah.
And James is almost too naive and too much of, quote-unquote, you know, a failure of a boy as this masculine figure to do the same thing.
Yes. You know, she can, you know, escape into Tom Jones music and just kind of play her cards without being pressured to prove herself.
Yeah, and I feel bad that we haven't talked about James's mother because there Oof. Is much, I mean, as the flip side to the masculinity of, yeah. right, of the escapism of masculinity within this community versus, I think, a lot of the weight falling on the women to shoulder reality when they have family.
Yeah, and the mother is such a figure of holding down the family.
Oh, yeah. And so you do have, I mean, apart. Yeah, you have this beautiful scene where she is dancing with her kids to, it's not Tom Jones, it's...
No,
in fact, she turns off Tom Jones much to Anne Marie's sadness. Yeah,
it's some big band.
Right.
Crooner.
And they just dance. And you can see, I mean, it's not escapism in the same sense as sort of as Ellen is taking by literally detaching herself and running away.
Yeah.
but it's escapism in the same sense of finding those pockets of humanity.
Yep.
Right.
And, you know, on the flip side, she's also, like, incredibly sensible. She doesn't have, you know, the father talks about, oh, when we get our house. She is very much, you know, Ryan Quinn is dead. His mother's offering you his shoes that were never worn. You need to take them, but they don't fit. Well, make them fit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
She understands she's the one that, her place in the world.
Yeah. And she's the one that shoulders that.
Yeah.
And I do think, I mean, going to the implication of James being gay, I think it represents sort of the missed opportunity that if only he had been given a little bit more freedom to be masculine or to not meet masculine standards, he could have approached it with the same sensibility of his mother.
I don't even know if he's gay. I think that's one interpretation you can take.
Right. Well, yeah, but certainly in terms of...
The sexual tension with Margaret Ann is really interesting. Whether it's... She is like a year or two older than him, but there's a huge maturity gap. And I don't know if it's he's unsure of what he wants to do or how he proceeds. He's clearly attracted to her, but I'm not sure if it's sexual.
Yeah, no, I think he's drawn to her because it's not that she is attractive to him on a sexual level, but rather that...
An escapist level.
Right, that she represents a person that he can connect with that isn't this band of toxic jerks.
Yeah.
And that she is someone who will be kind to him.
Yes. And she's aware of the class.
I wouldn't throw money down on James's gay being the interpretation as much as I think it is the failure. It's, you know, his failure to meet masculine standards. And from that, one could argue that that is part of that interpretation.
If you look at Lynn Ramsey's characters who are male, she does really deal with masculinity in an interesting way in almost every film. I wouldn't be shocked if he was heterosexual, he was just sensitive. And he struggles as a result of that, because that can be, quite frankly, incredibly divisive.
Right.
I mean, Glasgow's a rough city.
Yeah, and during a time when there is so much economic and interpersonal conflict in this tight, small, explosive community... It's not a good time to not be certain of yourself and to not know how to take advantage of what little power you have. And so finally, to bring this into another old film, we watched The 400 Blows, which was François Truffaut's directorial debut. It premiered in Cannes in 1959 and won Best Director.
Which is interesting because the year before, as a journalist, Truffaut had been banned from Cannes. Because he was being mean to the French filmmakers. This is kind of like the classic example of a director, you know, ridiculing someone's work. And people go, oh, well, you know, show it if you're so good. And then he comes back and just blows. He flips the entire French film scene on its head instantly.
I mean, it's incredible to think that he was relatively young at this point. I don't know his exact age. This was his directorial debut, and he basically invented French New Wave, which was
is where it begins.
The one of like the most formative, if not the most formative, like
film movements of all times.
Yeah, yeah. It
instantly established the idea that the director is an artist instead of part of a team, and like all film work is collaborative, but it instantly established the role of the director as the seminal artist on a film.
Yeah, it's an early starting point of auteur theory, where the director has a vision that they are working to bring to fruition through the film.
Where can people buy this?
So it's available in the US. It's available on Filmstruck and iTunes, Amazon, and Criterion has a Blu-ray and DVD releases of it.
The Criterion Blu-ray is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, it's a beautiful transfer. In the UK, Artificial Eye has released a Blu-ray of it,
which I believe people like who are snobby home theater people like I am actually give that one a slight edge.
Do they? That's as interesting. As far
as quality.
Interesting.
But Artificial Light is great, great stuff.
Okay. I don't think I've got anything by them, so I'll have to check them
out. Yeah, well, they're all region two, so.
True.
Yeah, Kurosawa called this film one of the most beautiful films he had ever seen.
And
that's high praise.
Yeah, I mean, Akira Kurosawa is, again, one of the greatest directors of all time. Yeah. Such an incredibly formative director in Japanese cinema. And a lot of Japanese cinema does take a lot from French film.
Yeah.
In its almost lyrical approach to filmmaking. Yeah, I mean, it's widely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time. It's got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. Like we said, it was a ridiculously influential project.
And it really, not just establishing auteur cinema, but also, you know, le camera stilo, which is concept of treat the camera as if it's the pen. The camera mm-hmm. shows what you would in literature show with a pen. It's really beautiful how it sets things up.
I would say some of the really important elements of French New Wave are similar to the director being the central focus of the process. Also, the characters have this intense individuality about yeah. them. It's often people, usually on the younger side, young people rebelling against norms and standards, not even necessarily because they have a cause, but simply because they realize that they are individuals and they want to exert that autonomy.
And I think as much as it's great to talk about the French New Wave as what it was, and like The Foreigner Blows is one of the key examples, like you know, see this and see Breathless, and that's going to give you a pretty good grounding in what the French New Wave meant. But I think the more important thing is how it changed every other film movement.
Right.
You know, you would not have the new Hollywood movement with these auteur directors like Spielberg and Coppola and Scorsese and
George Lucas. Don't forget George Lucas.
See, that's he's like that kid who he did change cinema, just not in the auteur way.
He did, you know, American Graffiti,
Star Wars is a yeah. hugely influential film, and it's incredibly important.
Yeah. You know, what it is now,
you know. I'd say the links to Kurosawa are stronger than the links to Truffaut.
Yeah.
But, you know, even you look at British realism, which is, you know, Ratcatcher and its predecessor, Kes, grew entirely out of this. Like, this is right. the turning point for, you know, this old Hollywood studio system, or even prior French film, where it's kind of done by the studio. It's very...
It's intensely sentimental.
Yep.
There's not a lot of probing that goes into...
You don't have to think
what
much.
Is this film saying? It's
entertainment, and entertainment for entertainment value, and that's okay. Like, that's great.
Yeah.
But if you want something that's going to challenge you a little bit, it's never going to really fulfill that.
Right. And that's really what French New Wave did, and that's why we speak of it, which...
And that's not to say it was the first, like, film to have artistic merit. I mean,
oh, yeah, no, absolutely.
Absolutely not. Look at what Orson Welles was doing. Look at what Hitchcock was doing in Britain at the exact same time. You don't think... Truffaut very famously admired Hitchcock.
You know, D.W. Griffith was intensely racist, but he also did have a good understanding of the role of the director in creating, like, artistic vision, even though it was...
And I think this is just such a great example that film is an evolutionary medium, because that mm-hmm. vision gets stronger and more concrete and more unique. With progressively
less racist.
I mean, can you really get less racist than Birth of a Nation?
I mean, can you get more racist? I think you mean you can definitely get less racist than Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
You know, one would hope. But yeah, so The 400 Blows, I'm gonna add that, speaking of Spielberg and New Hollywood, I would argue that really what François Truffaut is best known for is his role in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That's my crusade.
Wait, what?
All right, back to you, Kyle.
Sorry, what? Yeah.
Truffaut was in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Why did I not know this?
He was the French...
Oh my gosh, he is, you're right.
Yeah.
Sorry, I never connected mm-hmm. that.
You know, that's what I'm here for. I'm here to make the connections that everybody else is too afraid to. No, yeah.
Wow.
I didn't really Close Encounters that much, but...
Oh, I love... Close yes. Encounters was one of those films for me growing up that I just absolutely loved.
Yeah, I mean, again, just because we brought up Spielberg, and because I've been sitting on that bombshell of a news story. One day someone's going to catch on. Wait a second. That's the guy that did 400 blows. So Antoine Doinel is a young boy in Paris during the 1950s. He is a little bit of a rabble rouser. And when I say a little bit, I mean he does a lot of truancy. He cheats. He's pretty... I wouldn't say he's good at lying because he always gets caught, but he's...
He's terrible at lying.
He's good at making himself a liar. As all 13-year-old
boys are.
Yeah. At one point, he says that the reason he missed school was because his mother died. And you really have to wonder what is his idea of time linearity? He was going to get away with that one. To be fair, it's possible that his undoing was because there was a snitch.
Yeah.
But, so anyway... Antoine is, like we said, this individual pushing back against the system, not because he's got any good reason to, so much as because he realizes he can.
Oh, I think we do see, well, not against the system, but we see a reason for him being angry.
Sure, his family life is not great. His mother can be pretty harsh with him. His dad is alternately there and not really.
I mean, also just you have to deal with, like, there's obvious seeds of dishonesty within the family from the very first minute.
Right.
And we learn more about that later in the film. But, you know, you see the way the parents communicate. It's not hard to understand why he's acting out like this.
Yeah. And it is certainly, to a degree, an indictment of... When we say the system in this case, we literally mean early on... like French young boy schools, and the overbearing teacher who isn't necessarily...
He pets the dog, which is a film term for obviously showing his human side, but really, like, he is not a very personable teacher. He's very tough on his kids, and he doesn't do anything to really better that.
And he doesn't understand that he is part of what's driving them away from him.
Yeah.
And so... Antoine finds himself in increasingly rebellious behaviors and situations.
Becoming more and more criminal as well.
Right. He starts, you know, we start with basically some cheating in school, and then he skips school. He steals. He lies to his parents constantly. He's a very rebel without a cause-y.
Yep.
And when I say that, I mean the movie that came out after 400 Blows, but... It has that element of, like we said, the aimless rebellion because of this desire to exert individuality.
And, like, everything builds off of it. Like, so he's initially caught. Everything, obviously, you have this dishonesty in the home, but things are going pretty well for him. And then a classmate passes him a pinup photo, and he gets caught with it. So he gets in trouble. So he skips school because he doesn't want to talk about it with his parents. So he has to make up. So he cheats on his paper. So he runs away. So he makes up this lot. Like, everything snowballs, and he doesn't know how to control his circumstances.
Right.
And he just can't get a break. I think that's the core theme of this film, is he cannot get a break.
Yeah. And I think an important point in the film is... the realization one day when he's skipping school, he's out and he sees his mother with another man that is not his, well, I guess actually not his father, is his stepfather. But he sees his mother with a man who is not her husband. And that's not when everything has started to go. That's a little after everything started to snowball. But that's, I think, an important turning point for realizing.
He goes from a boy playing hooky to a boy who has given up on fixing things.
And the realization that this adults play by the same rules as he is, or not play by the adults play the same game that he is playing, which is breaking rules and pretending they're not.
Yeah.
And so as his antics become increasingly troubled and become increasingly noticed by authority figures, he finds himself ultimately in a juvenile sort of, it's not a military camp exactly, but it's a
corrective center for youth.
Right, a corrective center for youths.
With everything you'd expect from that in the 1950s post-war Europe.
Yes.
And we really, you know, we have all these monologues with the psychiatrist where we kind of understand, like, the problems in the home.
Right.
That led to him acting out. And we understand how his parents had kind of misrepresented his behavior.
Yeah, I would correct myself. I had said that. in this case that it wasn't that he had good reason to rebel, but what I should have said is he's rebelling because he's realizing that this is the system in place.
Yeah.
And it doesn't benefit him or other people in it all that much.
You know, it's one of the most famous film endings of all time. He finds a way to escape and he runs.
It's a wonderful ending.
And it's interesting because they established pretty frequently that the boys who run away get caught. Mm-hmm. But we end on him at the seashore, which is something he's always wanted to see. You know, it's, again, this kind of very similar to Ratcatcher. You know that it's not actually a happy ending, but you want to believe it.
Yeah, I would. Well, so I wouldn't actually say that it's not a happy ending. It is, I think, the way that I would describe it is we've established that boys that run away get caught. I think that's an important hook. But once he runs away and once he sees it, once he sees freedom, and even if it's not everything he wanted it to be, there's still that moment of sort of bewildered self-satisfaction where he realizes that he has grasped what he's been trying to reach for all this time.
Well, that's also like he's constantly running throughout the film. He runs away from everything and he's constantly like searching for something. It's been established from the very first minutes of the film that he wants to see the seashore. He finally gets there and he stops.
Right. Because he doesn't know what to do now. Yeah.
Yeah.
What movie is that? What movie is it? Where he's like, I'm like a, oh no, that's The Dark Knight. Ooh, getting my real art film credits in. He's a dog chasing cars. He doesn't know what to do now that he's got one.
Yeah.
And so it is, I wouldn't call it a sad ending. It is bittersweet, but there is also, I think there is an important moment where he has gotten what he wants.
Yeah. And also I think he's realized there's more to life. And so, yeah, he's probably going to get caught. He's probably going to go back there, but he's seen the world as much as running from this coastal French town.
Yeah. And that's similar to what another boy who is notorious for having run away tells him, is that even if you get caught, running away was worth it.
Because
you have that moment of having it.
I think one thing that's really interesting about this film is the fact that it's basically autobiographical for Truffaut's childhood. And which is, it helps the ending because you know that Truffaut, with a lot of struggle, did make it. That's just an interesting factoid that, like, it shows how much we remove the humanity from juvenile offenders and how much we mm-hmm. minimalize them and how mistreated they can be. But it also shows that resilience that, you know, if you inspire someone, they can push through and they can make it.
I think it's interesting to contrast it to Ratcatcher, where James and Antoine have opposite problems in that James is sort of unable to reach out and grab it, and Antoine is all too capable.
Yeah, and just not aware.
Right. They're both very classic coming-of-age films, but they come at it from a slightly different lens of what coming-of-age means and what it means once you've gotten there, or if you've even gotten there.
Yeah. Also, like, if you look at the class issues, you know, yes, there's a lot of dysfunction in his family, but they put on a good front of being happy, and money is talked about a lot, but not in the same way it's talked about in uh-huh. Ratcatcher.
Yeah, it's...
You know, they're not living on a thread. They're definitely working class. Or actually, it's even probably middle class.
Yeah, I mean, his father works as a... Right.
Works in an office.
And,
Yeah. I think... But it frames, you know, they're definitely middle class. Their apartment is very small.
At the same time, at that they're doing okay. Antoine's bedroom is the first room in the house.
Yeah, and you have it set against, you know, the Ninth Ward of Paris, which is incredibly gorgeous and bourgeois, and they're just, you know, they have a very simple existence.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of great cinematic language that goes in the film. There's a lot of focus on the architecture, as that visual representation of systems.
Even just the opening where, you know, it's kind of a point of view of someone in the back of a car, just not in control of where they're going and just kind of driving around.
Right. Again, not dissimilar from Ratcatcher's bus scenes where...
And I think both of these are kids trying to have control over their circumstances. That is the core movement.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful film. Like, the cinematic language is amazing. the repetition of certain themes is really poignant. It's essential viewing.
Yeah, and it is idealistic a little bit in ways that Ratcatcher refuses to be.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I was trying to get on. It deals with class, where, yeah, they are not as poor as the family in Ratcatcher.
Mm.
But it also deals with class, where it kind of accepts the system while Ratcatcher rebukes the system.
Right. It doesn't quite...
Antoine's best friend is upper class, very upper class, and it kind of shows his... Antoine's father goes to work. His best friend Renee's father goes to the races.
Right.
Like...
Yeah, it Truffaut doesn't quite get to... I don't think he quite gets to realizing... Or not necessarily realizing, but the focus of the film is not as much on the economic system that puts it in...
But it's a nice undercurrent. ...that puts
people in this place. Right. It's more of the authority system of the school and of the parents and of the juvenile correction facility.
Yep.
Rather than the economic conditions themselves.
All right.
Yeah.
That's you should check out these films. They're all fantastic.
Yes, for sure. And
like every single one of these films is must watch.
You know, a lot of people, like Kyle was saying, it's like probably very likely that You Were Never Really Here will end up on Prime Video. So that might be...
It will. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, that'll probably be a really easy way to check it out. And the other two are also... Well, Ratcatcher's a little bit harder to find. But 400 Blows, I'm sure you can find it somewhere on the internet.
Ask your local library. They probably have it.
400 Blows, yeah, I would say for sure.
On our next episode, we're going to be watching Chloe Zhao's new film, The Rider, which is coming out on streaming services and Blu-ray very shortly. And we're going to be tying it into other films that have dealt with kind of Midwestern American land, like an actual dedication to the land and also the themes of Native American peoples. We're going to be watching Terrence Malick's Badlands, which is a brilliant film.
Yeah.
And
folks love Terrence Malick.
Everyone loves Terrence Malick, except for when Terrence Malick becomes too Terrence Malick. And for our third film, it's a surprise.
And by surprise, we mean... we might not really know what it is yet.
So you should email us saying what you think we should watch.
So if you have any suggestions, recommendations, or feedback for us, we'd love to hear it. You can email us at framesofreference@bravevoicefilms.com.
And don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes and Google Play. Those 5-star reviews really help us become more visible.
I mean, if we're 5-star worthy, if you listen to these guys are a bunch of
we
bunch
are
of yeah.
check out some awesome film podcasts that are definitely better than us: the Criterion Cast, Linoleum Knife, Fix a Flick, and Film Spotting and Fighting in the War Room. I'm Kyle.
I'm Matthew.
This has been a production of Brave Voice Films.
Thanks for listening, you nerds.